And good morning and welcome to this April 5th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access those later in the show. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. So happy to be doing what we always do, which is welcome authors onto the show. I'm excited this morning to welcome back Jonathan Lethem to the show this morning. He's joining me now, and in the second half, I'll chat with memoirist and short story writer Deb Olin Unferth about her latest short story collection, Wait Till You See Me Dance. Jonathan Lethem is the New York Times bestselling author of 10 novels, including A Gambler's Anatomy, Dissident Gardens, Chronic City, The Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn. He has at least one other essay collection out, The Ecstasy of Influence, which was a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist. He was on the show with me back in 2009 to chat about Chronic City. You can find a podcast of that interview up on our website. A MacArthur Fellow and a winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, Jonathan's work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stone, Esquire, New York Times, on and on. The book today is More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers. It's published by Melville House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Jonathan, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming on. 2009 is the last time we talked, and I'm sitting in the exact same chair, and you've been super productive.
And I'm not sitting in the exact same chair because I moved to your neighborhood since then. I'm talking to you from Claremont, California.
That's what I heard, that you're at Pomona. Are you at Pomona College,
right?
Or are you teaching at
Pomona College?
Yeah. That was my dream school that I did not get into back in the day. Yeah. And I just took my daughter there on a college tour, so it's still my dream school.
So maybe I'll be teaching your kid, is that what you're saying?
That would be fantastic. I would love that. If I could get in again, you know, if I could do this all over again, I would. It's a great, great school.
You know, I tell my students all the time that I would never have gotten into Pomona College. It's way too hard for me.
Yeah, it's like the number one liberal arts college in the country right now, I think.
By some accounts, yeah.
Yeah.
And, we're pretty smug about it.
I bet. I would be. So A Gambler's Anatomy just came out last fall, and this collection came out last month. And clearly in the midst of all this writing, you obviously do a whole lot of reading, which I feel like you must have more, and you're teaching. So I feel like you have more hours in your day than I have in mine. But
well,
super productive.
Insomnia is a tool.
Yeah.
And my kids have just gotten old enough that I kind of reclaimed my reading life. So this is a well-timed, I mean, of course, this book really collects stuff I've written for 20 years. It's a scattering of, you know, occasions, places where I've been asked to review a book or introduce a book. And so it looks like I've been suddenly very industrious, but it actually gathers up all this older material. But it is a good time in that I feel like I'm in the heart of my reading life again. The younger one is 7 years old, and so suddenly that kind of possibility is alive, and I'm reading a lot of, well, there's a lot of new stuff that excites me that isn't even mentioned in this book.
Yeah, I can see a part two of this book coming down the pike someday. So this is a collection of almost 60, I mean, call it more than 50 and less than 80 essays, forewords, reviews. As you said, written kind of over more than a decade. It's kind of literary criticism meets fan mail, meets college lecture, meets fun author trivia. Am I describing it kind of right?
That's good. I like that. I mean, fan mail is definitely in there. And, you know, anything that, you know, novels are self-portraits. They capture an image of you for, you know, two or three or four or five-year stretch of your life, thinking every day consecutively. But a book like this is even more, in a way, of a personal mirror. You know, I think the first time I was ever asked to introduce a book was for Walter Tevis's Mockingbird, the almost unknown novelist anymore, but he wrote two books that were turned into very famous movies, The Man Who Fell to Earth and The Hustler, the pool shark book that was turned into the great Paul Newman movie. And this is another novel of his called Mockingbird, which is a kind of, well, a dystopian story. It would be very in fashion right now, and a beautiful allegorical kind of coming-of-age story at the same time. And I think I was, let's see, I'd probably published two novels. I was probably, working on my third novel when I was asked to write that introduction. And that's in this book. So this is really, it really captures me learning to be the kind of person who would do more than just read a book, but would sometimes review it or introduce it.
Yeah. Was it, what was your experience like since it was written over such a long period of time of looking back over these essays? I always think it's, reviews or whatever they might be, I always think it's interesting to see where I was at particular times, what I was thinking about, what I was writing about. And if you felt that your thinking had changed on any of these, or if, you know, you wrote something 10 years ago that kind of surprised you, or what was it like to kind of look at yourself in hindsight over that period of time?
Well, there's a lot, a lot of different feelings that went into that. Some of those that you propose, and also, you know, a lot of temptation to just quit the scene in total disgust. It's really important to say that this book was organized and edited by someone else, and I don't think I could have done it myself. But a young novelist, a marvelous young novelist named Christopher Boucher, who's associated with Melville House, which is why, one of the reasons why that's the imprint on this book, gathered up this really giant chaotic pile of stuff, and with me as a sounding board, I was always available to him to discuss what he was finding and what his leanings were, but he really made the selections and turned it into a book, because the truth is there was about three times as much material as is in here, and a lot of it was terrible. A lot of it would have broken my spirit if I had to reread it and try to assess it, because I would have started to think I'd made more mistakes than not. You know, there are lots of reviews I've second-guessed, and there are even a couple of those in this book. I wrote a little afterward to my piece on Ishiguro's When We Were Orphans, where I admitted that I'd had a chance to talk to Ishiguro in person and kind of run my pet theory by him about, you know, what the book meant, and he was completely... You know, he was helpless. He just said, "I'm sorry, none of that is in there." And I knew, as an author who's been in that same situation, that he was telling me the truth, and that my piece was just full of my own crazy projections. But I sort of liked him anyway, and so I thought maybe I could inoculate my mistake and turn it into a win if I confess this. So I put the piece in there, full of the crazy projections, and then I said, "And here's why this piece doesn't make sense." So, you know, you learn a lot and you grow a lot as a reader and also as a participant. You know, there's a kind of something intoxicating about being asked to review books or being invited into the, what's the posh word would be, like the world of letters, to become part of the, you know, the voices, the chorus, assessing everything that comes out and, you know, negotiating or navigating what the canon should be and which contemporary writers are, you know, are leading the way. And so, you know, you can get a little drunk on that occasion at the time. It can be like, well, I'm getting to declare this guy. This dark horse is really the best person going. And so a lot of it sometimes seems rhetorically a little overblown. And I did my best to mostly push those pieces out of this collection with right. Chris's help.
I'm glad you brought up that Ishiguro essay because, I thought it was great. And I really liked this idea of, you know, layering your own. I mean, the relationship between writer and reader, I think, is really a relationship. And so layering your own interpretations and meaning onto work, I don't think is invalid. I think even if the author didn't see it or agree with you or see anything there, I thought that was an interesting way to bring the reader the reader's own layer into a text, and to watch you do that, I thought was very valuable. I thought that was a great essay.
Oh, that's nice that you say that. And, you know, I completely agree with you that a book, if it's any good at all, it's like it's a trap for consciousness. It's a place where someone is going to go to have an experience, and they're completing it with their reading act. You know, it's like a scene. It's a place where something's going on, and you can't control that scene. And I mean, I think that's why laying the cards on the table as a reviewer or an introducer and acknowledging some of the subjective or personal conditions that apply. You know, this is what I came to this book with. Here's the kind of reader I am. Here's what I was hoping for, or here's what I compared it to. Rather than disguising yourself behind a kind of blind of, imperial fake objective authority, just seems to me like one of the basic responsibilities in that situation.
Right, right. It feels fair to say that your literary tastes run a really wide gamut. I mean, there are wonderful mysteries and sci-fi and traditional, you know, kind of literary, obvious, what am I trying to say, classic novels.
Well, there's a few canonical,
right.
People like Dickens and Kafka in there.
Yeah. Are there commonalities you can kind of distill as you look across your literary taste, even things that might not even be in here, but kind of what gets your attention, what sparks your interest?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, the baseline, of course, is, to make it sound a little bit salacious, I'm looking for sensation. I want to, find more of that buzz, more of that action that gets me excited, and that usually consists of something happening, at a number of different levels. I like to be lit up by the sound of the voice. I like the language to do something. I like the form of the book to do something. I like to be surprised. I like the characters to be, stranger than the average person I meet, because if not, I could just, go wander around and look at how strange people are, which is very. I want to be arrested by thinking. I want to feel the presence of the author thinking behind the page. I would say all of those things are, virtues that I'm always in search of, and then, finding them in different forms, in different containers. What else? There's very little I like to read that isn't at least a little funny.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty much a basic ingredient, because again, the world is really funny. It's really uncomfortably odd and off kilter, and so I want to see that reflected. I don't want to be told that everything's normal and fine.
Right. Yeah, Ed, I guess that kind of harkens to the title of the book, which is Less Lonely. And I do feel like a lot of people turn to books as friends. A lot of introvert friends of mine, like me, turn to. And, they're kind of companionship and understanding and less loneliness from books. You can get that almost more from books than from people, but the thoughts are so distilled. But,
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very special kind of communion with another human being through this crazy, mediating object, which is so not them and so them at the same time, if it's working right. If you're connected and your brain hooks in and you're like, oh my God, I want to just think the way you think, and I'm going to do it for a while because your book gives me that chance.
Right. I love it. Jonathan Lethem is my guest this morning. The book is More Alive and Less Lonely. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I really enjoyed reading about your relationship with Thomas Berger, how that developed and how it ended. And it kind of made me think about the importance of writers' relationships with other writers and kind of in whatever form they can take. But if you can tap into a relationship with an established writer, what a gift that is. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your relationship with him and
sure. Yeah. It's such a strange story. It's really almost like something he would write, of this kind of, I'm this apprentice. It almost had an All About Eve quality, right? I was like tugging on his sleeve and writing him letters and badgering him to read my early stories. And he was tolerant at first. I wouldn't describe it as anything more than that, but he was an extremely a kind of old world, genteel, elegant correspondent. And so his letters were generous even in their cursory qualities. When I was, in my 20s and sending him these, frankly, pretty scrappy early attempts at fiction, he would write to me and tell me what they suggested to him, and he would accept my flattery of his, towering novels, with a very amused but charming kind of responsiveness. And those letters were like, they were just manna to me that he had bothered to write back to me. And it made me, of course, vow always to write back to anyone, who ever troubled to, actually put a postage stamp on an envelope and find an address and get something to me. Of course, nowadays that isn't as likely to happen. People will just, work the network and find some way to come at me electronically. But it was, this was the late 80s when I first approached him. But then as I finally had something really to offer, and my first couple of novels, it did interest him. They partly were influenced by him. The tone of my first book, especially Gun with Occasional Music, with a hard-boiled detective story, was based a little bit on his Who is Teddy Villanova, his own crack at the hard-boiled detective genre. And he got it. He was interested. And then we became, pen pals, epistolary friends. But I was in California, and he was in New York, and we couldn't meet. And by the time I started, our friendship really flourished in that way. But by the time I started being in New York again often, he was quite old, and he'd become really reclusive, and he just declined to meet me in person. So he was like this mystery uncle, like the guy who sends Kane all the money in Citizen Kane or something, but won't spend time with him. He kept me at arm's length in a very fascinating way. And then as he failed in his later years, I think he came to depend on our friendship in certain ways. It was a lifeline because he'd isolated himself and he didn't have a lot of family, and his wife was even older than he was, although he actually predeceased her slightly. She was in her 90s and he was in his 80s, and he was taking care of her in an isolated house. And I think I became kind of one of his, at least I was a consolation that I was still there on the line, in a sense. And he ended up involving me in his estate. He let me come and pillage his bookshelf after he died. So we never met in person, but I did enter that house eventually, and it was very poignant to be part, in a way, of the kind of mopping up of this, strange end game that his life had come to. When you are a reclusive writer, you could end up as Pynchon or Salinger, with a lot of people badgering you and wanting to know what was going on. And you could also end up as Bert Berger did, I think, kind of a little bit forgotten, partly because you'd stopped communing with other people. And I ended up in a real twist, which I guess I'll say it's in the book, so I won't tell the story at length, but I ended up scattering his ashes in the Hudson River, which ran right behind the old house that he lived in and died in, because in a way there was sort of no one else to do it. But it's very meaningful to me that ended up happening.
Yeah. So it's a lovely collection. There are two or three essays, I think, in here, stories about your relationship with him. It's really lovely. You're right, and poignant. One of the many pleasures of this collection are the connections you're able to draw across work and about people's work, making obscure observations, both, kind of literary and cultural, because of the kind of expansive mental canvas you have to draw on. I mean, there's references to Batman and Disney and
a lot of people wouldn't call that an expansive mental canvas.
Twilight Zone.
Poisoned by pop. But I always like to kind of permeate, Kafka and the Twilight Zone and Batman and Ishiguro, and because that's how these things came to me, all at once in a giant crazy cultural package, and I just, they seem to me to be interrelated. And I think, you get some, Ishiguro may have denied the Batman connection, but if you look at a, Jean-Luc Godard movie like Alphaville, you realize that he, he loves B-crime stories, that's part of what he's doing, is referencing, the way I do, just the world of cultural noise and the energetic quality that, vernacular culture provides us.
Well, and it makes a lot of inaccessible writers feel more accessible, I think, to people who feel a little bit intimidated by some of these books, some of these writers. You provide kind of a nice gateway into, you know, accessibility of maybe I shouldn't be so afraid, or, you know, maybe I should.
Oh, well, I hope that's the effect. I mean, it isn't programmatic, like, oh, if I drop this, you know, Batman reference, that'll sort of empower the reader, or, you know, if I compare Dickens' Dombey and Son to Wind in the Willows, everyone will think, oh, then it's like easy and fun. But I mean, you know, Dickens is easy and fun. You just have to kind of remember that this stuff isn't on some high pedestal. It's really just for use, and it's usually kind of delightful. Yeah. There for you.
I love it. So there are a lot of obscure writers in here. There's so many writers in here I had not heard of and who I've written down now to go look up. I was wondering if you could highlight a couple of people that our listeners might not otherwise have known of, who they can pick up your book and kind of get a little introduction to them, but
you know, that's
kind of why they're your favorite and why we've never heard of them.
Well, you know, that's a great invitation. There's so much wonderful stuff out there to read, and it's never really an accident that you haven't heard of a writer, because there's so many writers. It's always astonishing and, you know, wonderful when someone attains a kind of reputation or, you know, or visibility where everyone feels like, oh, I better read that. That's, you know, that's important. But the world of fiction, if you care about it, it's just gigantic. You know, much bigger on the inside than it would look on the outside. I mean, I'll mention Russell Greenan, who I wrote an introduction to his first novel, which is called It Happened in Boston. And I think Russell Greenan is still alive and has even continued intermittently to write novels and add to a shelf. But his time of being, you know, kind of somewhat visible, being a little bit famous, was in the 60s and 70s. And his first novel is as great a book as he ever wrote, and then there's a few other really great ones that follow shortly after. I haven't read every last one, but It Happened in Boston is this story about a kind of beautifully naive art forger who's a genius. And he's, he starts as a painter, a sincere painter, who wants to work in the style of Leonardo da Vinci. He wants to emulate him, and he's not intending to become a forger, but he's working in this kind of, he reinvents da Vinci's methodology, and he uses his materials and, you know, really, really learns how to become kind of early Renaissance painter. And then this guy who's got some of the qualities of a beautiful idiot. He's like a character in Confederacy of Dunces, or in a way, like my character in Motherless Brooklyn. He's gloriously alive to the world, but he's also terribly innocent and easily manipulated. And he falls into the hands of some people who realize that they can use him to forge a persuasive Da Vinci and sell it to a museum. And it's just so loving and so meticulous a book. I mean, it's a great tale. It's just a great tall tale. It's, the voice is incredible. The picture of Boston in the 60s is very interesting, and it's irresistible. Anyone would love it. It just happens, you know, to have fallen out of print for a long time. But I think it's back in print, still in that edition that I introduced for the Modern Library. So not too hard to find. Russell Greenan's It Happened in Boston.
I love it.
There's an infomercial for you.
I love it. It is on my list. It's on my list. So at the end of every show, I always ask the author what's their favorite advice to give writers, and about half the time they say read, 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 which is probably an indication that I should quit asking the question. But I feel like the answer is so often the same.
Well, I'm glad they got that out of the way. I would have said it. Yeah. But I have something maybe a tiny bit more distinctive, which I always urge read, and the second one is write a lot, right, obviously. But one thing I always say to apprentice writers is, you know, don't forget to keep playing at it. Invent yourself slowly. Play at different possibilities. Wear masks. Wear disguises. Try different things. You know, it's dangerous to try too hard to just kind of locate your voice, as they say, which I think is, you know, usually kind of a chimerical thing. I'm not sure there is a voice in there. I think a voice is a constructed thing. And I think it's constructed by active impersonation, play, trying diverse projects, different genres, different forms. You know, write a villanelle, write a science fiction story, you know, do first person and third person, write a novella. Just keep things polymorphous as long as you can. I mean, eventually you probably will discover there's a kind of thing you like most or are best at, and that the world is pushing you in that direction if you persist at writing. It's often that you'll end up more or less doing one kind of thing. But hold that at bay if you can. Keep it playful for a while.
I love that advice. I there's actually a short story contest that I always do called New York City Midnight, and they give you a genre and they give you a character, and there's like 25 different genres. And who knew that I actually enjoy writing science fiction, and I can promise I would have never tried it other than being given an assignment to write a science fiction story. So it's a good way to, just to echo your advice, to kind of be forced into, if you have to be, or coerced into, trying out different things and different ways of exploring your voice. And, yeah, I think that's really great advice. Actually, one of the questions I was going to ask you about that is if you have any advice on how to read, as a writer, because you know, you obviously read across genres, you read across times. And I was wondering if you have advice for writers on kind of how to make the most of their reading and kind of how to read.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess in some ways I would just transmute the same advice. I would say read promiscuously. Try different things. Surprise yourself in your reading as well. But, you know, the way that writing changes your reading life is built in. I think you slow down. You start noticing structural things, the sentences and the formal moves a bit more. Instead of being totally immersed, you're like swimming on the surface a bit more, which can be, you know, sometimes it's a bit of a loss, but it does, in turn, I think it sends you searching for works that are so great, that are so immersive and so extraordinary that they will disable your ability to diagnose them and be technical, and instead they'll thrust you back into your sense of wonder. I think that's one reason that as writers age, they tend to go and start reading great, you know, classics a lot. Not out of some pretentious, you know, attempt to, you know, only talk about the classics, but or out of some dislike for the contemporary or anxiety about new writing, but because you're looking for those experiences that will just throw you off your game and into the that fanish sense of awe that you felt, when you were first reading.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best way for an experienced writer to recapture that feeling is to, you know, read. Frankly, it's like read War and Peace or The Brothers K or Lady Murasaki. Something that just is the boundaries are just so extraordinarily gigantic that you get lost in it.
I love it. That is great advice. That is great advice. Jonathan Lethem, it's always a pleasure to have you on.
My
we have
pleasure.
To do it.
Thanks
we
so
have to do it more
me.
More often than every 8 years. So
that'll be good. I'll look forward to that.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks again.
That was Jonathan Lethem. The book is More Alive and Less Lonely. It is out and available now. We didn't even get to talk. There's so many wonderful writers in here that I love. Lori Moore is in here. Philip Dick is in here. Who knew Philip Dick had, a whole earlier career of novels that I hadn't even heard of. So if you're looking for new things to discover, new old works that you didn't know were out there, this is a great, great way to do that. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Deb Olin Unferth will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. You can also follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We're all over the place, and we have tons and tons of shows. We figured out we're celebrating, we're coming up on our 20-year anniversary. Can you believe it? Is coming shortly. And so anyway, we've been doing this 20 years. Barbara's been doing this 20 years, and I've been doing it 10. And every single Wednesday morning, we bring you these great people. And today is no exception. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Deb Olin Unferth's the author of Minor Robberies, Vacation, and Revolution, The Year I Fell in Love and Went to Join the War. It was a finalist for the National Book Circle Award in Autobiography. Her latest collection is short stories. It is Wait Till You See Me Dance. It's published by Grey Wolf, and we are going to talk about it this morning. Deb, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I love these stories. I love flash fiction. There's a lot of flash fiction in here, a lot of short shorts, and I'm just a fanatic for the short story form. So always a delight to have short story writers on. So I'm going to let you introduce the collection, but I know you've been writing short stories for a long time, but they've never assembled into a collection. This is your first collection, yes?
Well, it's the first collection, a full-length collection. Full-length. Minor Robberies was a book of just short shorts.
Gotcha. Okay. So tell me, tell us about this collection. Kind of, if you always knew, were you just writing stories and publishing them and then said, I'm going to put together this collection? Or did you kind of always have a collection in the back of your mind? Kind of talk about how these came together.
Yeah, sure. No, I've always wanted to have a collection, a full collection, and so I had been keeping a pile of stories that I knew would be in there for a long time, and I just sort of kept adding to them. And then, I mean, I think that the biggest question was whether I would be able to combine longer stories and short shorts together in the same collection, and how would that, you know, what would that look like? And so it was my editor, Ethan, at Grey Wolf, who kind of talked me into combining them. He thought that that they have a very similar voice and a very similar style, and but that they're attempting very different things, and that there was sort of a playfulness in putting them next to each other. And also, when I started to think about it, I started to think of it as they're sort of, I always like to think of my work as like little songs, and so to have a selection that are just short shorts, and then to have these longer stories, there's something very sort of song-like and rhythmic about going from long, short in the way that I've arranged it. So I wound up being very happy with that.
I totally agree with him. Yeah, it really worked. There were a lot of as you're saying that about a song, it's true that you know the short shorts are kind of like breaths and pauses in music, and the longers are kind of melodies and refrains. And you're right, there were a lot of similar themes that kept coming up. That's a really nice way to look at it. Do you listen to music? Do you have like a soundtrack in the back of your head for these?
Well, I mean, I listen to a lot of Bach, and I really like the inventions and the fugues. I love when there are several different strands that are kind of repeating and going in different directions and fragmenting and then coming all back together. I love that kind of an arrangement in just about any, just about, you know, also Bartok does that a lot, and so I really like his work. So I felt like with the short shorts, they feel almost like percussion or something. Like they're very, they have a sort of a percussion sound to them. And the, whereas the longer stories, I always think of sort of more kind of Mozart-like, you know, sort of, I can imagine kind of three movements. Anyway, I mean, I'm not a musician at all, so That's just my sort of abstract way of thinking about it.
I love that. I love that. I was wondering if for the shorter flash fiction pieces, because you play around with a lot of different forms. I mean, there's second person, there's lists, there's little opera, hilarious, very funny opera, little summaries. There's a lot of different ways to play, and I think you can do that in flash fiction in a way that even in a short story, it's more difficult. You can do it, but it's very hard to do in a novel and make it work. But I was wondering if you gave yourself like little challenges, or I'm going to try the, kind of how you came up with the ideas for a lot of these playful flash fiction pieces.
Yeah, I do that all the time. I give myself little challenges, just things like, can I write a story in three sentences, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I do that, but those are really, a lot of those are just sort of like practice, just to kind of keep my hand in the game. But most of the pieces, most of the short shorts at least, they arrive at my brain sort of whole, completely written in my mind. And it's usually either something that I've heard, like there's a pretzel story in there that was a story that my dad told me. And it was, I wrote it down basically just exactly like he said it, and just sort of stuck it into the story. I sort of stuck it into the book as a story about my mom and dad going to a factory to find whoever made these pretzels that my mom has been eating all her life. So like that's one example. Or then I also sometimes, what happens is that I have a thought, and then that thought just keeps repeating in my mind in different variations over a period of days, and then I find it just sort of formulating itself into a short, and then I write it down. But then that's not, then they're not finished. It's like I write it down, and then they sit around in a pile for sometimes years, just getting little revisions. And I just will go through the stack, and then every once in a while I'm like, oh, this one's done. And then that one I decide is finished. And usually the worst thing about it is that sometimes they don't even look that different from when I started. It just had to sit there for 2 years for me to decide it was done.
That's interesting. That's interesting. It's so funny you brought up that pretzel story, because, these flash fiction pieces, I mean, you can read one like right before you go to bed, and then you just think that, oh, this friend told me, as you're saying it, I was like, oh, that was in this book. I thought a friend of mine was telling me about this. It kind of gets integrated into your head because they're short, and they're almost like little snippets of conversation that you could have had with a girlfriend, or, and they almost attach themselves to your brain kind of in a different way than a novel would have. I think that's interesting. And then your observation that maybe something doesn't need more work. It just needs more time away from you for you to go back and look at it as a different person, or, with different person's experiences of whatever's happened to you over the course of 2 years, you go back to something and then say, yeah, that's done. That's ready to go. Have you ever had the experience of publishing something, and then maybe when it came into this collection, you're like, now I'm going to tinker with it some more. Actually, maybe it wasn't done, and I'm going to keep working at it.
Not so much by the time it gets to the collection, but I did have at least twice as many stories that aren't in the collection.
Okay.
So there were a lot of stories that I published that then I later decided I didn't think were good enough to go into the collection. But most of the ones that made it into the collection got very little revision, because they had already been published. They'd already gone through edits with an editor. They'd already made it past so many hurdles that then the revisions that I finally made were very, very minor, just a word here and there.
Right, right. And not every short story does a collection make. I mean, I always think a collection of short stories, also the stories have to be in conversation with each other, and they have to, at least be kind of dancing around the same themes, even if they don't look alike. They have to kind of feel alike.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, and I feel like I worked really hard to do that in this book. I feel like a lot of the stories have to do with, especially the longer stories, are people who are trying to help other people in different ways and usually failing, or succeeding in ways that they didn't expect to succeed, or like helping people as a kind of a quest. So I tried to make a lot of the stories circle around that kind of, that was like one thing that I tried to get in there a lot.
Yeah. I saw a lot of defects, a lot of people struggling with their defects and not being who you want them to be. They're kind of disappointing each other. I mean, I guess that's just life, but that was a theme that kind of stuck out to me that I really enjoyed, that people were trying so hard and just kind of failing each other in a various myriad ways. It was heartbreaking and funny. So
we are flawed. We are flawed people.
It's funny, as I was reading this, I thought to myself, I wonder if Deb was a philosophy major. And then I came across something that said you were. Yeah. And I was like, that's so funny. I mean, I was wondering totally for self-serving purposes, because I was a philosophy major. But I also wondered if that served or sort of undermined your writing. Maybe not now, but maybe back in the day when you were a new writer, because philosophy is so rigorous and logical and fiction isn't. And I was wondering if it made it easier, or if you kind of had to unlearn a certain type of thinking, or kind of how that, if it still plays into your writing.
That's such a great question. That's so interesting to me that you were also a philosophy major. Actually, I was, but I wasn't very good. I mean, I managed to get A's, but I think that's, you know, that was just because, you know, it's not that hard actually to get A's, it turns out, if you just do the reading. I think I was a sort of a flawed philosophy major. It always felt more emotional to me than the arguments always felt more emotional to me than I was being asked to regurgitate them as or think about them as. And so it was so easy for me. It felt just completely natural for me to take those arguments that I was learning and definitions. You know, philosophers are so into thinking about the meanings of words, and to take those skills and those that method of argumentation and analysis that I had learned and just apply it to things around me. And that turned out to be a really winning combination. That turned out to be just the way that I think about the world. So I have pieces where, like, the first story in the collection is called Likeable, where there's a woman who's thinking that she's no longer likable, like that the older she gets, the less likable she is. And so I tried to use this word likeable all the way down the page in sort of different combinations and in different ways, so that by the time you reach the end of the story, the meaning of the word likable is much more sort of layered and complex, and you've looked at it from a lot of different angles. And that's a really philosophical move to make. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I do that everywhere in the book. I'm so glad you noticed that.
I love that. And your war experience, we should mention your autobiography or your memoir, Revolution. I'd love for people to just know a snippet of that, because a lot of that, I think, informs a lot of these short stories as well.
Well, yeah. So when I was 18, I dropped out of college and went to Central America to try to join one of the revolutions that was going on there with my boyfriend, which was an example of one of these people who didn't really have a whole lot of business trying to help other people and was trying to do it and not very good at it. So I wrote a memoir about it. It did inform. I mean, there's several stories. There's at least a couple stories in there that are take place in Central America. And also just the whole idea of, like, you know, how do you help someone is permeated through the book. Like, you have this teacher who is trying to help a young student who, if he doesn't pass this class, he's going to be sent back to his home country, where he'll be drafted and sent to war. And she doesn't really know how to help him. And then there's another story about a guy who volunteers at a prison. I run a creative writing program in a maximum security prison in Texas, and in southern Texas. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how to help people and about inmates. There's another story in there. There's a little snippet from one of the men I talked to who had been in prison for a long time, called Fear of Trees, where he's talked about being afraid. When he was finally released and coming home, he hadn't seen a tree in so long that he was afraid of the trees, that they were going to collapse on him. They just seemed so tall and huge and terrifying.
Amazing. And there was another story in there about getting a guy out of a country and kind of expecting that he would write about that experience. He'd been imprisoned or something in another country and prisoner of war, and the expectation was that he would want to write about that, but he didn't. He wanted to get away from it. And it really does ripple through a lot of these stories. It's great. It's funny that
that particular... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go.
Well, actually, that particular story, that's really funny because how it was in like the real world was that it was someone who we let into our graduate program here at the University of Texas who had been an inmate in prison, and he had applied to the program, and we let him in thinking that he was going to, you know, write about his experiences at the prison. And when he first got here, that's not at all what he was doing, and it was fine. It was sort of funny. He did then start writing about the prison, but I just remember thinking it was so funny because we had argued on his behalf, you know, that he should receive a TA ship and be allowed to teach here, even though he had not, even though we generally don't hire convicts, that he should be allowed because he was going to go on and he was going to write all of this, you know, this important work, you know, about the prison, and then he got here and he wasn't doing it, and it was so funny. But now actually he is, and you will start to see his name very soon, so
oh,
it's exciting.
That's great. So you mentioned the title story, Wait Till You See Me Dance. You kind of briefly touched on that. I thought it would be kind of fun, or you could choose any story. I was thinking of that one, but we could choose any story. But I thought it would be kind of fun to spend a few minutes deconstructing a short story and kind of talk about the original kernel of the idea, the point of entry for you, and then how the story got fleshed out over time, how the metaphors got chosen, how the characters developed, any surprises that came out of it. Did it end as you thought it would? Kind of the revision process. Is there a story in here that makes sense to do that with? Or
Sure, any of them. But yeah, sure, we could talk about the title story if you like.
Yeah. So take us into that. What kind of how that story started, what the original little spark was for it, and then, you know, kind of how long it took you to work on, if it ended as you thought it would start, and kind of your process of creating it.
It did. It took me a long time to do that, to write that story, because I had to keep sort of layering in conflict. I think that the original story was that it was sparked when I was an adjunct teaching at a school in Chicago, and one of my students asked me if I wanted to go to what he said was what he called an Indian dance, which I had no idea what he was talking about. And so I rode with him. I rode with him across the countryside. I mean, it took us hours to get there to this Native American dance, and he had brought his own costume with him to wear, and it was a really interesting experience. And so I just sort of wrote it down, and I thought, you know, this is really an interesting little tiny piece, but it didn't really have a lot of conflict, and it was there just wasn't a lot there. So I started adding in other things from the experience. I mean, it has a lot of little tidbits in there from the experience of teaching at that school. Like, there's this class in the story that is you can take it as a pass-fail class. It's for people who haven't made it, who haven't fully been admitted to the school, but who want to come to the school, and it's sort of like an entryway class when you haven't, you can't get into 101, composition 101, because your writing isn't strong enough yet, so you take this other class, and then if you fail it, you have to leave the school. Well, in reality, it was you could take it twice, or maybe even three times, I can't remember. You could take it over and over again and try to pass it, but I started writing about little things like that that I thought were just very interesting, little tidbits. And then I just kind of started carving a story out. Like there was a student who couldn't pass the class, and he had come from a war-torn country, and so I just started adding a lot of conflict where I could find it. And then I thought, so why would this woman want to help him? I kept asking myself, why would she want to help this kid? And then, and it was even that was slightly based on reality, because we were at this time the United States was bombing Serbia, and I had a student who had come late in the semester and had been invited to come as a refugee and come to the United States and be in my class. And he had arrived a couple weeks late, and if he had stayed, he would have been drafted and probably he would have died. And so he was not in the class where he might fail and have to leave the school. He was in regular 101 because his English was fine, but it was really interesting to imagine what it would have been like if he had been in a class where he might have to leave and go back. And I brought in that risk, and then I thought, but why would she want to help him? And then I thought, maybe she's in love with him. And then I thought, but why would she be in love with him? And then I thought, what if he is a great artist who she's afraid that, she feels like, this great art should be in the world, So it just went on and on like that. And then I had to think about, like, how far would she go to save him, And then I was trying to think, like, what could she do that would be so outrageous that, would just really, really up the tension in the story.
So
and then I thought, the thing that happens, the horrible thing that she does, which I don't know if you want me to say.
No, don't say. It's okay. People should read this. It's okay.
But I knew very early on the scene that it would end on, which was the office assistant and the narrator dancing. I knew that would end the book, but I didn't know what the emotion was going to be behind it and, what it was going to look like, or I didn't know what else. I just knew that they were going to be dancing at the end.
That's so great. One thing that occurs to me as you're talking is how many risks you take in your own life that have really served your writing, that by going to work in a prison or by, joining the Sandinistas in Nicaragua or getting in a car with some guy to drive hours and hours into a Native American dance. Like, I feel like if you say yes to a lot of random opportunities in life, it really will feed your, if for no other reason to do it, it will really feed your fiction.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Although I never do anything in order to write about it. That's a policy. I think I already am kind of a risk taker. I've sort of always been someone who's up for adventure. And certainly my husband would say so, to his dismay. But I never take any kind of risk for writing. In fact, I don't do anything for writing. I want to live my life. I just want to be a person in the world who loves and is sad and who goes through all the things that a person goes through without this thought in the back of my mind, oh, I could write about this. There's something about that doesn't appeal to me.
So you have the experience, and then as you're looking back on it, you find nuggets that came out of it that can feed your fiction rather than the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, sometimes I even have to sort of go through on the other side. Like when I first started teaching at this prison, I thought, this is a great thing to write about. So I was having that thought. But then, this was when I taught actually in a maximum security prison in Connecticut. I had that thought. And so when I came to Texas, I loved teaching there. And so when I moved to Texas and I thought, oh, I want to do that here, there was no program, so I had to start a prison program in order to teach in it. And when I was trying to start that up, the prison had me sign for all volunteers have to sign this statement saying that they're not going to write about it, you know. So I had this sort of moment, like, wait a minute, I can't write about it? It's not that I'm not allowed to write about it. It's that, you know, I have to get permission. You know, I have to turn it into the prison first and have them approve it to the warden. And so I was just thinking, so I thought the whole point was, you know, that I was going to, like, you know, have something to write about, you know. But then I was like, do I sign this thing or what? And then I was like, I really want to go and, you know, do this program at the prison, you know. So I just signed it, and I have no thought about writing about it because I'm not supposed to. So it's been such a great experience. Like, it's so important to me to be doing this. And, you know, I'm sure it will come out in some way. I'm sure that, you know, right now I'm just focusing on trying to get my students to a point where they can publish and, you know, tell their stories, which is even better than me doing it, to, you know, gain empathy for what they're going through and understanding. So that's a great example of me just saying, like, okay, I'm not doing this in order to write about it.
Right, right. Oh, we're out of time, and I have so many more questions. Your story sounds so much like Wally Lamb's, who did the same thing in a Connecticut prison. So there's so much to talk about. We're out of time. Deb Olin Unford, this was so great. Thank you so much.
It was so terrific to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. The book is Wait Till You See Me Dance. It is out now. It's published by Grey Wolf, a press that I absolutely adore. So you can find that. And hopefully Deb will keep writing quickly so we can have her back on, because there was so much more that I wanted to talk about. That's all the time we have for today. You've been tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Stay tuned for more great music, eclectic music coming up next. And we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, have a great week.